Chapter 8, wrapped around the woman's slim, swaying hips, was what looked like a piece of brocaded silk. Other than that, she wore nothing but long, black hair, perfect breasts, an even tan, and a smile. Miller was not the type of man to leer or ogle. He was a tenured professor at UC Berkeley, the granddaddy of all politically correct institutions, and he would never have made it that far if he had a construction worker's attitude toward women. But this woman was so perfect, so beautiful, and so wonderfully unclothed that for a minute all he could do was watch, with his jaw hanging and his mouth dry. It was Cook who brought him back to Earth.
Correct theory, Tony,
he said softly.
Inhabited by scavengers. Safety now in question. Suggested action.
Miller snapped his eyes reluctantly off the woman and onto Cook.
I suggest we find out if these people are actually hostile, he said.
Cook looked alarmed.
Confrontation inadvisable,
he said urgently.
Location of artifact, primary urgency. Possibility of rescue.
We're not going to be rescued, Jay. Just as you say, everything that comes near this island crashes. We've got to find out what makes that happen and figure out a way to neutralize it. Then we can get the plane working again and get out of here. But we can't do a thing on an inhabited island if we're trying to hide from the natives. So,
he said, turning back to the woman,
we have to find out how friendly they are.
Hormones dictating action,
Cook hissed.
Irrational state of rut causing impolitic decision.
Cook grabbed his arm, but Miller pried off his fingers.
I understand what you're saying,
he told Cook.
But I'm not being influenced by that woman's looks. The fact is, Jay, we can't get off the island, and we can't avoid these people. Confrontation of some kind is inevitable. It will go better if it starts from us.
And without waiting for a Cook's objection, Miller stepped into the clearing.
Ask her about the artifact!
Cook hissed at him before crouching back down behind a bush. The woman's back was to Miller. She had continued toward one of the huts, constructed from a beautifully rebuilt 1930s luxury yacht made of teak and mahogany, and carried her water pail inside. Miller followed, unconsciously straightening his clothing, and arrived at the doorway to the hut only a few moments after the woman had gone in. He knocked on the door frame, built from a mahogany side rail.
Hello?
There was no sound for a moment. Then he heard splashing, the thump of the bucket, and the woman came out. She had obviously been washing with the water she'd brought in, because even the small swatch of silk brocade was gone now. She came to the door totally naked and looked out at Miller with a warm smile and the totally unself-conscious attitude of many Polynesians. She raised one hand to the doorframe, placed another on her hip, and said,
Aku, ahau.
As nearly as Miller could make out. Once again, he felt his mouth dry up and his tongue stuck to the roof. He tried hard not to stare, but it must have been obvious to the woman that he found her attractive. She gave a low, musical laugh
Ah-ha-ha.
And beckoned him into her house. Miller followed. The inside was simple, but many items were displayed that had clearly been gleaned from various wrecks without a clue as to what they were intended to be. A teak toilet seat, for example, hung over the door on the inside. It was beautifully carved with god faces and what looked like runes, similar to the ones they found on Runapuake. As they entered the main area, Miller glanced up. The ceiling was made of sheets of overlapping metal from airplane fuselages. He could even make out a few letters and numbers. Lock, with a star superimposed, and then a separate chunk, probably a tailpiece, that read NR, and under it, partly cut off, a 6020. The woman led him into a cooking fire in the center of the house. Around it, a scattering of pillows from several eras lay on the packed earth floor. She beckoned Miller to sit on one. The next few minutes went by quickly. It may have been much longer, but to Miller, it seemed only moments. The woman did not appear surprised to see him, almost as if he were expected. But of course, they must get visitors frequently here, he realized. Where had they gone? Had they been absorbed into the culture? Or what? As sinister as his speculation was, the professor and Miller quickly took over. How much had the shipwrecked of all ages contaminated this culture? Would the Polynesian traditions of hospitality be in effect here? What would this strange and wonderful hybrid culture find valuable? But these questions would have to wait. He could not concentrate at all in this woman's presence. She sat very close to him, behaving with all the dignity and propriety of a matron lady in a corset, in spite of the fact that her bare breasts were continually brushing against his arm. He tried to put that out of his mind and listen to what she said. Miller spoke or understood several of the Polynesian dialects, but not the one the woman spoke. Yet her words seemed oddly familiar to him, until, at last, it occurred to him that her speech contained more of the Polynesian root words than any other dialect he knew. It was as if she was speaking the original tongue, the one all others in the region were based upon, which was just possible, assuming that these people had been isolated for a few hundred years. Concentrating intently, Miller managed to piece together the vaguest outline of what the woman was trying to tell him. Her name was Yuki.
Tony,
he said, pointing to his chest. She repeated it.
Toenia.
And laughed.
Ha.
He thought it was the most wonderful laugh he'd ever heard. He smiled, and she smiled back, reaching a fingertip up to touch his lips. The touch of her hand felt like a jolt of electricity, and his head was swimming. The fresh, clean smell of her was intoxicating. Miller had always thought it was total nonsense when poets and the writers of popular songs said things like that, but now it was happening. To him. What was going on? Of course, he was not in love with her, not after seeing her for the first time only a few minutes ago, but it was a powerful attraction, beyond anything he'd ever felt before. Yuki was speaking again. Miller dragged his concentration back to what she was saying. Something or other was forbidden or dangerous, or was it just on the mountain? The words were so close, and what was it, anyway? She didn't seem terribly worried about whatever it was. Because it would happen to him? Or because he had done something and deserved it? Again, he could not quite make out anything exact, just a vague sense of the direction the words were going in, but nothing specific when they got there. Still, the voice and the words were so beautiful. He didn't mind. He was willing to spend as much time as he could on this problem. Yuki stopped speaking suddenly and looked up to the door of the hut. The smile was frozen on her face, and she stopped moving, even her eyelashes, like a deer caught in headlights. Miller turned. A man stood in the door. Striped pants billowed around his legs, and a bright yellow sash hung about his waist in the style of some 18th century buccaneers. And on his head, he wore a Japanese army helmet, adorned with what Miller recognized as two beautiful cap-caps, ceremonial ornaments carved from pearl shell. He wore no shirt, and his chest muscles were impressive. Framed by mahogany railing pieces, the man looked as hard and dark as the wood. His face was carved with deep lines from anger. Behind him, Miller could see a crowd of perhaps a dozen people, with possibly more beyond them that he could not see. The man spoke to Yuki. The words that had sounded like pure liquid music coming from her sounded harsh and rough from him. He pointed to Yuki and to Miller back and forth several times. Miller got the sense from the words that he was not pleased to find them alone together, but he didn't need to understand the dialect to figure that one out. The man's face gave it away. And apparently, Yuki's answer, part reasonable explanation and part injured innocence, did nothing to improve the pirate's mood. He took two huge steps across the room and glared down at Yuki. Then he turned to Miller and grabbed the front of his shirt. He easily pulled Miller to his feet and stood nose to nose with him for a moment, just glaring. Tony Miller was not an easy man to push around. He had size, strength, and training, and when he needed it, he had the combat temperament. A tough childhood and hard military service had seen to that. But this wasn't some drunken redneck picking a fight, or some type A screamer cutting him off in traffic. Miller knew that in the blink of the eye, he could easily have the pirate helpless on the ground. But if he did anything to hurt this man, he was jeopardizing his life and whatever future he might have on this island. There were other islanders with him. They were filling in now, circling the two men and Yuki. So instead, Miller simply placed his hands on the pirate's where they gripped his shirt front and pried the other man's fingers open, gently pushing the hands away. Then he stepped back and gave a small bow. The two men simply stared at each other for a long minute. The pirate seemed to be working himself up to some kind of a move when a commotion began outside the hut. Pirate turned away from Miller and followed the others outside, pointing to Yuki and Miller to stay put. Miller glanced at Yuki. She smiled at him, apparently unworried, and looked out the front door. Miller looked too. He could hear voices chattering and children shouting, and in a moment, two men appeared in the doorway, dragging Cook between them. Pirate stuck his head back inside and motioned, saying something to Yuki at the same time. It was clear he wanted them both outside. Yuki stood up in one graceful motion and held out her hand to Miller. He took it, and they went outside the hut together. Well over 100 people were gathered in the open area at the center of the village. There was a great deal of talk, but very little of it seemed to be serious. Instead, the people milled around, talking with each other and looking at Miller and Cook. They did not seem terribly interested in or surprised at the strangers. Instead, they seemed to be waiting for something to happen that would involve the two newcomers. Cook leaned over to speak to him.
"Relevant phrase occurs,"
he said.
"I told you so."
"We'll get out of this,"
Miller told him, with a confidence he almost felt.
"These people are too isolated to be warlike. And there's plenty of food here, so there's no need for either ritual or practical cannibalism."
"Need,"
Cook said.
"Look at the children, Tony."
Tony looked. The children darted in and out of the crowd, dodging around the legs of the tolerant adults. They seemed happy and healthy.
"What about them?"
he asked.
"Signs of a closed gene pool,"
Cook said.
"It's a small population,"
Miller said.
"No new bloodlines."
Cook nodded.
"How many water air spacecraft have landed on island?"
Miller shrugged.
Hundreds.
"Where are signs of interbreeding with survivors?"
Cook asked. Miller looked at Cook. His point was clear. If these people had not eaten or sacrificed the survivors of the hundreds of ships and planes that had crashed on this island, there should be some small genetic sign, like a child with blue eyes or reddish hair. Instead, the kids looked enough alike to be siblings, and there were fewer of them than there should have been for a population this size. Was there a high rate of infant mortality, or was it something more sinister? Like a large number of defectives from inbreeding, all killed at birth. It was not a comforting thought. Miller knew the double edge of Polynesian culture better than most. It could be seductive, warm, and welcoming, and simultaneously cruel and deadly. He'd noted the pirate had not hit Yuki, and she seemed not to fear that he would. She was not property, not second class for being female. But pirate also showed no hesitation in confronting him, and it was clear that he and Cook were not being invited to hang out and party.
"I still don't see any indication that these people are hostile,"
Miller began, but before he could say more, the crowd fell silent. Miller looked up. Walking toward them was an old woman, not a bent and withered crone, but a large woman, authoritative, and even majestic in the way she moved. Her white hair was pulled back and held in place by a comb made of human finger bones, and she was dressed almost entirely in red feathers. She carried a staff made from what seemed to be the machine gun from a World War II era bomber turret, topped with the eyepiece from a periscope. A dozen strings of human ears, some of them ancient, hung from the staff. Around her waist was a red sash hung with other dried bits of flesh. And with a horrible lurch of insight, Miller recognized them as human male genitalia.
"I think I see some of the hostile signs now,"
Miller whispered to Cook. The woman, clearly the chief or high priestess, stopped in front of them. She looked long and hard at Cook, then at Miller. She was almost big enough to look him in the eye, and Miller found that he unconsciously came to attention, as if he was being inspected by a commanding general. The big woman nodded approvingly.
Bakadoa,
she said, inclining her head to Miller. He felt his pulse quicken. He knew the word, or a word close enough that he was sure they had originally been the same. Matatoa, in other dialects, was a member of the professional warrior caste. They were universally feared and respected. This dialect changed a few consonants, but it had to be the same word. The chief clearly thought Miller was a member of the warrior caste. Would he be welcomed as such? Could his protection extend over Cook? The whole crowd looked at him with friendly approval, now that their chief had proclaimed him a warrior. Miller felt better. Even if there were some ritual challenge, he was confident in his fighting ability.
What just happened?
Cook asked him.
They think I'm a Matatoa, a member of the warrior caste,
Miller explained.
That probably means they won't hurt us.
Certainty?
Cook asked doubtfully.
Just relax now, Jay,
Miller reassured him.
We're going to be okay.
End of chapter.